From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, two journalists shot and killed during a live broadcast in Roanoke, Virginia. Over the weekend, a sheriff's deputy in Houston fatally shot while pumping gas. And there's Aurora, Charleston, Lafayette, Newtown, America's bloody drumbeat of gun violence. No developed nation comes close to our death toll. Can we really not do something about it? This hour on Point, American gun violence. 33,000 dead, gun-related deaths a year in this country. We're looking for a way to break America's paralysis. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do we seriously dial back the American death toll by gun? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The question here put plaintively by Andy Parker, the father of Allison Parker, who was one of those gunned down last week by the gunman in Roanoke. He questioned how many more attacks, like the one on his daughter, Americans will have to endure before stronger gun laws are put in place.
How many new towns are we going to have? How many Sandy Hooks? How many people, how many Allisons are going is this going to happen to before we stop it?
But we're all over the place. Here he was, the father, saying he might have to get a gun himself.
I don't own a gun. We don't have a gun in our family. I'm probably going to have to get one. I mean, sad to say, but, you know, unfortunately, that's just the world we live in.
We lead the developed world by a long, long piece. How do we bring this down? Joining me now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Sandy Houseman, Charlottesville Bureau Chief for WVTF and Virginia Public Radio. Last Wednesday in Roanoke, Virginia, Vester Lee Flanagan killed Allison Parker and Adam Ward on live TV. Sandy Houseman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
So what is the aftermath here? We've heard the Virginia governor talking about background checks, but would Mr. Flanagan have sailed right through a background check?
Well, it appears that he did. He bought his two weapons, actually, two Glocks from a federally licensed seller and passed background checks. He was a guy who had had clearly emotional problems, a lot of trouble in the workplace. He was known to make threats, and people described him as angry, but he did not have a police record and was therefore okay to buy guns.
Have we learned anything more about the depth of his or the nature of his motivation here?
Well, he wrote a 22-page, what he described as a suicide note, and faxed it to ABC in New York. And there are a number of clues to what might have been driving him. I'll just say that, you know, this was a guy who he was African-American, and he had worked at a number of stations where he claimed his fellow employees were racist. And he said that the shootings at the church in Charleston had essentially put him over the edge. That was the last straw. He may also have been gay. He complained about discrimination based on his sexual orientation at WDBJ in Roanoke. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission looked into that, and they found no evidence for those claims. The station's manager, Jeff Marks, said Flanagan, who was known on the air as Bryce Williams, was hard to work with. He was combative. The station forced him to get help through an employee assistance program, but eventually they had to let him go. He was very disruptive, and he did not take that well. He had to be escorted out by the police, and at the time he warned a news editor that he was going to, quote, make headlines, end quote, out of the incident.
And indeed he did.
Exactly.
Dylan Roof, the gunman in Charleston, cited the Columbine High School killers before he went on that shooting rampage. Now we've got Bryce Williams or Vester Lee Flanagan citing him, a kind of chain going here, a very grim chain. Here was the governor, this was Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat, renewing his call for tougher gun laws on WTOP last week.
Everyone who purchases a firearm in the Commonwealth of Virginia should have to go through a background check. A background check, as I say, I've done it three times. I own three hunting rifles and shotgun. I hunt. You go into the store. You hand your license over. It doesn't take, Mark, but 3, 4, maybe 5 minutes maximum.
This was live on TV last week, these two killings, just horrifying. And then he was tweeting and posting more on it about Facebook before it was all over, killed himself finally after that, 200-mile runaway from the scene. What is the conversation beyond the governor here talking about background checks, which Bryce Williams or Flanagan would have passed, apparently? Is there any other conversation about a change in gun law, procedure, anything here in Virginia, Sandy?
We're not hearing it yet. I imagine that there are conversations going on among lawmakers, but the governor, of course, started talking about stronger gun control laws, more restrictions on who can own a gun almost immediately, even as the shooter was on the loose. He was talking about this, and Republicans in our legislature seized the opportunity to criticize the governor for politicizing a tragedy. And McAuliffe shot back that, you know, this isn't about politics. This is about people coming home from work at the end of the day to their families, to their friends.
Stations obviously still on the air. I shouldn't even say back on the air. They never went off. But what a trauma to live through.
Absolutely. It's, I think, doubly difficult in a way for journalists. There's a sense among some of us anyway that we have some kind of protection, that we stand apart, that we're, you know, observers but not involved and therefore not at risk. So this was really quite shocking.
33,000 gun-related deaths a year, too, on live television last week. That's a grim turn of events. Sandy Houseman is bureau chief for WVTF and Virginia Public Radio, joined us from Charlottesville. Sandy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And over the weekend, more. Speaking with reporters in Houston on Saturday, Deputy Thomas Gilliland described the shooting of Deputy Darren Goforth.
He was at the gas pump pumping his gas into his vehicle. A male suspect came up behind deputy and shot the deputy multiple times. Deputy then fell to the ground. The suspect then continued over to him and shot the deputy again multiple times as he laid on the ground.
An American story, and it's played out again and again and again. Each one has its own peculiarities. We'll look more at that one. But the numbers add up like nowhere else in the developing world. Nick Kristof joins us now from New York, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. He's been thinking about the Virginia shooting. He's been thinking about shooting in general and how we have been kind of paralyzed, what we might do. Nick Kristof, welcome back to One Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
We go through these spasms of revulsion, and then we go right on shooting each other. What should change here?
You know, I think that we need to essentially take a new approach to this. Advocates of being engaged have often focused on kind of a prohibition model. And in fact, that has largely resulted in a backlash from the gun community. I think the way we need to think about this is guns in America as a public health crisis. And there are lots of products or lots of things in our daily lives that we allow to be around, that people find enjoyment from, and yet that we regulate to make them safer. You know, swimming pools, ladders, and maybe the best example of all is cars. People tell me all the time when I talk about the need for regulating guns, they say, look, you know, we have cars and they're deadly and we don't ban them. Well, true, we don't ban cars, but we have taken extraordinary efforts over the decades to make them safer through regulation, through better design, through better design of roads, through driver's licenses, insurance requirements, all kinds of things. And the upshot is that we save an incredible number of lives on the road. And I think that's kind of a model for what we need to do with guns.
Nick Kristof, you laid out some of the scale of the problem in this country the numbers that make this look like an epidemic that might justify a public health approach. Walk us through some of those, just how fierce.
Sure. Well, you mentioned one at the outset, you know, that always just staggers me, that since 1968, you know, the Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King shooting, since then, we've actually had more Americans die from guns than died in all the wars in American history back to the Revolutionary War up to the present put together.
That is unbelievable. And we know the death toll in those wars, the Civil War and more, but more from guns shooting each other on the streets and everywhere else in the country.
shooting each other, but also I must say that includes suicides. Gun suicides mm-hmm. outnumber people killing each other with guns by about 2 to 1.
It's amazing in itself.
And there are also accidents, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, another staggering figure, in 6 months in America, we lose more Americans to gun violence than we've lost over the last 25 years to terrorism, you know, put together and to terrorism and wars. And the if you look at how we compare to other countries, we are again off the charts in availability of guns and how many guns are in American homes, and we're off the charts in the consequences. We have, if you look at industrialized countries, member of the OECD, mm-hmm. then we have 7 times the rate of gun homicides as that in the number 2 country, which is Canada. We have 600 times the level of South Korea. America has American kids age 5 to 14 are 14 times as likely to be killed by a gun as those in industrialized countries on average. You know, we are huge outliers here, and I think they're pretty good lessons to learn from countries that have somewhat similar backgrounds, like Canada, like Australia, like Switzerland, that have a gun tradition but have managed to make those guns safer in society.
Maybe time to do something. You remind us 33,000 people deaths in which guns are involved, 33,000 every year.
92 every day, 92 people every day. You know, it's the one, it's the killings like the one in Roanoke that get all the attention, but this is a daily occurrence, 92 people.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's world-class gun violence problem and what to do about it. Minister there singing on eagle's wings at an interfaith service for Allison Parker and Adam Ward, the two journalists killed in Roanoke, Virginia, last week at an interfaith service over the weekend. Nick Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times, has been thinking and writing about this. He joins us today from New York. With me in the studio is David Hemenway, professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health, author of Private Guns, Public Health, and While You Were Sleeping. David Hemenway, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And with us from Washington, Adam Lankford is here, criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama. Adam Lankford is the author of The Myth of Martyrdom. Adam Lankford, thank you for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
You've got some numbers. Nick Kristof has walked us through some, but help us again to understand what an outlier the U.S. is in terms of gun violence and gun death. Give us some comparative framework here globally, Adam.
Sure. Well, I did a study of essentially all public mass shooters from 1966 to 2012 around the world. I studied 171 countries, and I found that in terms of public mass shooters, the United States had nearly a third. It had 31% of total offenders and 5 times as many offenders as the next highest country.
That puts us sort of in a class of our own. I don't know if you looked at this, but does that hold up when it goes beyond mass shootings to just gun violence, gun death?
Sure. And in fact, there are a lot of different types of gun violence where we are number one in the world. And of course, we're also number one in the world in firearm ownership rate and total number of firearms. It's amazing when you look at the total number of firearms. We have something like more than 200 million additional firearms than the next highest country.
I think I read somewhere there's one for every man, woman, and child in the nation.
Right. And of course, you know, you really shouldn't count babies, although we do see the occasional thing where a young child gets his or her hands on a gun and shoots the parent as well.
David Hemenway, Nick Kristof has picked up your theme that this is a public health crisis. It's not a new theme. You've made this case for years, but here we are, 2015, and the drumbeat goes on. Do these numbers say to you that this is justly put in that category of kind of epidemic or automobile death or pollution, all the things that have affected public health over decades?
Absolutely. This is clearly an enormous public health problem for the United States. And again, has been emphasized, this is compared to the other developed countries. They don't have this sort of public health problem that we have in the United States. And if we're going to decide to stay with a country which has lots and lots and lots of guns, we have to figure out ways to live better with these guns.
I want to look at what a public health response to this might look like. But Nick Kristof, just calling it a public health challenge or crisis doesn't take it out of the realm of politics. I mean, it never seems to leave that realm. So what's the advantage in looking at it this way?
You know, there are a couple of things. I think one is that the way we've that liberals like myself have often talked about guns has been in terms of sometimes in terms of banning in ways that have just ended the conversation and got people's backs up. Mm-hmm. And I think that there may be a little more sympathy among some gun owners to kind of tweaking the model. And for example, polls even of NRA members suggest that they are in favor of universal background checks, even though the NRA itself is against that. Likewise, you know, while the you know, many gun owners are utterly against smart guns, against research into guns, it seems to me that one could plausibly get political support for research into gun deaths, into how to make us safer, into research into smart guns, into limits on trafficking, you know, maybe limits on purchases to one a month, things like that that strike me, you know, there's no silver bullet here, but in a sense, there's silver buckshot. And some of those buckshot are going to be politically unpalatable, especially at a federal level. Some of them will be possible at a state level. But there may be a few buckshot that actually are possible at the national level.
Let's let our listeners hear what some of this might look like and think about it and decide. I mean, David Hemenway, if you look at this challenge in a public health framework and approach it in that way, what does that suggest? Nick Kristof just reeled off a few potential steps there, but put it in that frame for us. Okay, yeah. It's a public health problem. Yeah. How do we begin to think about it? How might that change the way we organize ourselves?
So public health, I think that the key is to try to figure out a way to make it easy for people to stay healthy rather than difficult.
And okay, so if you make it difficult, seat belts and airbags.
And more than that is like collapsible steering columns, where instead of dying when there's an accident, nothing happens. Or you get
You walk
injured.
Away. You may have black away. Eyes, but you walk away.
That's right. And so that's where you – and the other thing in public health, I think, is to try to get everybody involved. First, you have to say this is a big problem. Secondly, instead of sort of pointing the finger and saying who's at fault, say what can we do about it? How can we solve the problem and who can help? And the answer is in this area – since we're going to have lots of guns, lots of people can help. And it's a lot about changing social norms as well as changing laws.
So Australia went out and collected something like 600,000 guns and just took them out of circulation. And it had a big effect on their gun violence rate.
Yes.
You're not proposing that here. I mean, one public health answer would be like, well, you know, we get syringes out of public parks. But we're not talking here because it's politically just not on in this country.
Right. And I think that's absolutely right. The same way as we don't say, let's get rid of all the cars.
Okay.
And so if we're going to have a lot of guns, what can we do? And there's so many different things. So, for example, in terms of suicide, the public health community is working with gun distributors, trying to figure out a way to make sure that when someone comes into the shop and says, I want a gun, what kind? Oh, I don't care. How many bullets do you want? All I need is one. That you don't sell that person again. You get that person mental health as opposed to giving them the gun.
Is that realistic that gun shop owners are going to
absolutely.
Become amateur
and
psychiatrists?
And they don't have to be amateur psychologists. There's some things which are clear that people are not really gun people and that they really want guns for a purpose which they shouldn't have, and you're trying to help them. And you can figure out a way to train people to do that.
Okay.
We're working with groups in Boston to try to reduce gun trafficking. What we know is that when a woman buys a gun, she's much more likely to be a straw purchaser than when a man does.
So what do you do about that?
So you help work with women to empower them to understand that, A, when you're buying a gun illegally for your boyfriend who can't buy a gun, that this is a felony. You can go away for 20 years. Mm-hmm. This is ruining the community as well as your boyfriend, and that a good boyfriend would never, ever ask you to do that.
So that's a public really education campaign.
In that sense, yeah.
Okay.
We're trying to figure out ways to make gun training better, so that instead of focusing only on things like gun accidents, which are important, but that there's also a module about gun suicide, which every time there's a gun accidental gun deaths, there are 30 gun suicides.
Yep.
You want to make sure that people are trained in how to reduce the violence rather than just how to shoot someone when there's a problem. But there's all lots of people we want to get hairdressers involved. We're trying to get clergy involved.
Why hairdressers?
Well, the hairdressers are being involved now with this campaign.
Talking to women.
Yeah, helping to get women together.
You're
to make
naming
a difference.
Things that seem relatively non-controversial. Relatively. In this realm, I think everybody, every step can have some controversy. But could you really cut down on the numbers of deaths without getting into the controversial stuff?
I think you could do both. One of the things in the motor vehicle area was that we had to do about 50 things to mm-hmm. reduce the motor vehicle deaths, and that there was no big panacea. I mean, I'd worked for Ralph Nader, and we had pushed for airbags, and airbags mm-hmm. are wonderful, but they only reduce motor vehicle deaths by about 10-11%. There's about many, many other things. And I think one of the things to do is to look for easy successes to start with, working with gun groups. So they're getting public health and gun groups together to say, look, there are lots of things that we can work on together that will make a difference. Then there are other areas we may disagree on. One of the things, for example, that we found in our most recent survey was that 40% of the most recent acquisitions by gun owners, there was no background check. And it's like, come on, guys. We want to change gun culture in two ways. One is that there's always a background check. And secondly, to change social norms so that it's not moral to sell your gun to a complete stranger without a background check. How can you consider yourself a good Christian and do that?
So there's public persuasion again, just getting that up on the rails. David Hemenway, stand by. Nick Kristof is with us from the New York Times. Adam Lankford from the University of Alabama. Lots of callers for all three of you. Gray in Hendersonville, Tennessee. Gray, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My congratulations to your panelists for giving us some numbers, particularly the numbers of guns. When you think about this question, I hear a lot of how people are killed, how people kill other people deliberately, and there seems to be a lot of concentration on that, as though that will be some sort of end-all and panacea to end this. What we're talking about is violence. When we're talking about deliberately killing other humans, we're talking about why. I have heard no one address the why. Why do other humans decide to kill other humans? And when you look at that and you get into the number of gun deaths and then other deaths, you see the numbers are absolutely small when you compare, for instance, 300 million guns and 33,000 gun deaths. That's a tiny fraction of the amount of guns killing people that are out there. So let's get into how, not only how, but why. Why are humans killing other humans deliberately in this country, and what can we do about that? You mentioned Canada. When you look at the numbers in Canada, as our culture has begun to spread, where our culture, whatever you want to call it, is beginning to spread, there we also see humans beginning to deliberately kill other humans. There is a very much real loss of the perception of worth of human life that is going on, and that's much bigger, I think, than how someone else is killing. I want to get into why the other. Why?
Gray, we'll do that. I don't know that the availability is not a significant factor here, but let us pick that apart. You raise a really interesting issue. Nick Kristof, come at that, the how and the why.
I mean, great. You're absolutely right that any one gun is very unlikely to be used for a murder, for example. One economist looked at swimming pools in a house and a gun in a house and found that a swimming pool was actually more likely to be associated with an accidental death than a gun in the home. But when you have this many guns in the country and you have disputes, you have disputes between domestic partners, you have people who are feeling suicidal, and, you know, sure, without a gun, people might stab each other, they might attempt suicide in some other form. With a gun, any of these disputes or suicidal tendencies become much more lethal. You know, I grew up in rural Oregon in a community where guns are widespread. I got a 22 rifle for my 12th birthday. I sort of emerged from that world. And it's true that most of those guns are used safely. But I do remember one time when somebody gave us some ducks on the farm. We gave them to a neighbor, and the ducks then wandered over to a different neighbor's vegetable garden. And so the vegetable garden owner went and yelled at the other one and said he was going to shoot the ducks if they came back. And the first neighbor pulled out his gun, and then the other neighbor pulled out his gun. And, you know, you almost had a shootout over
ducks
some ducks
in the garden.
And that would not have happened without this extraordinary availability of guns. If this had been knives, they would not have ended up in a knife fight. And so while any one gun is very unlikely to be used in this way, when we have this many guns in America, this many disputes, this many husbands and wives sometimes fighting each other, then the lethality of these disputes or the lethality of attempted suicides is so much greater. And that's one reason why we need to try broadly to try to make this culture safer. And there are things we can do, as other guests have noted.
Adam Lankford, I mean, you've looked at mass shootings in particular. Gray's calling in and saying, why? Is there something that you've found in the American psyche that makes that mass shooting more likely than elsewhere? And is it just because guns are available, or is there something more than that?
Well, it's certainly more than that. You know, we can talk about the fact that most of these attackers, specifically the public mass shooters, are struggling with mental health problems, and that leads to both their delusions of grandeur, which seems to have a specific kind of American tint, where in this country, well, for instance, according to the Pew Research Center, 51% of young Americans say that to be famous is one of their most important goals. And it seems like in this country, compared to other countries, being famous is valued higher. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, as we saw with the Roanoke attacker this week, you know, by killing with guns and doing
on
such
air
a dramatic thing.
In his case. Yeah.
Exactly. He guarantees himself fame. But what I guess I would say is that there's the how and the why, but sometimes even the attackers themselves don't fully understand the why. And it's not just a matter of either they're going to kill or they're not going to kill. The easier it is for them to kill, the more likely that they do it. And I have a specific example of that. A German school shooter who actually had posted online, quote, "I decided to leave it alone. I don't know if in the end I would really accomplish anything." And he says, "Damn it, I don't know where you get decent weapons in Germany." You know, this is an individual who couldn't find weapons in Germany, and for 17 months, he actually engaged in no violence until, unfortunately, he did find a gun and committed a school shooting. But wouldn't it be great if in this country people changed their mind because they were saying, well, I don't know where it's easy to find a weapon?
But when we're so far from that, David Hemenway, I mean, the availability just seems to be pretty much like water.
Yes and no. It really depends where you are. To backstep a second, one of the things we've learned in public health from all the successes in public health is that, yes, you'd like to try to change people, but it's very, very hard. What's always much more cost effective is to try to change the agent of injury and try to change the environment. And that's where you have the great successes. In the suicide area, the great successes have always been trying to get the most lethal weapons away from people. This was true in England when people used to commit suicide by putting their heads in the oven. Now you can put your head in the oven and after a while you take it out because the gas is no longer lethal. And we went from 50% of the people dying putting their heads in the oven to 0%, and non-oven deaths didn't change at all.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about America's world-class gun violence problem and what to do about it. The latest, of course, the live on-TV killings out of Virginia last week. But really, it never ends. The murdered policeman at the gas station over the weekend, 33,000 gun-related deaths in this country every year. More deaths since 1968, gun-related, than in all the battlefields, in all the wars in American history, Nick Kristof reminds us, back to the Revolutionary War. Think about that. Are people, politicians, talking about it? Yes. Last Wednesday, Hillary Clinton in Iowa.
It happens every day. Intentional, unintentional, murder, suicide, it happens every day. And there is so much evidence that if guns were not so readily available, if we had universal background checks, if we could just put some time out between the person who's upset because he got fired or the domestic abuse or whatever other motivation may be working on someone who does this, that maybe we could prevent this kind of carnage.
And yes, there's Hillary Clinton talking background checks. You've got Republicans talking that way as well, but no new laws. Here's Chris Christie.
The fact is that we need to have more information about people's mental health background, but we don't need new laws in this country to be able to do that. We have laws that exist now.
Laws that exist now. We'll talk about new laws. And then behind everybody, the NRA just working to keep it wide open. This was 2012, Wayne LaPierre, executive VP there, after the Sandy Hook Elementary School mass shooting.
The only way to stop a monster from killing our kids is to be personally involved and invested in a plan of absolute protection. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Well, in that case, we don't have enough good guys. We've got plenty of guns, but our death rate is unbelievable when you compare it to anywhere else in the world. Jim in Atlanta, Georgia. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
My thought on this is that you have a perfect example in kind of an Obamacare model where you think about you know, the way that we regulate vehicles, we require insurance, we require inspections. And it fits perfectly within your public health discussion in that you could simply require that anybody who owns a firearm have a liability insurance in order to own it. If they have to pay monthly in order to maintain liability insurance for a gun.
And liability against what? Against what eventuality?
Well, public health. I mean, a gun that sits in somebody's closet for 5 years until mm-hmm. and then it's only used after it's stolen in a burglary. I mean, the person who has that gun for their own self-protection is going to think twice if they're going to pay for 5 years of monthly insurance.
And what you mean is if someone died in an illegal fashion by their gun, that their insurance company would have to pay out?
Well, that's one part of it. But think about who is best equipped to do these mental health evaluations that politicians talk about. It's not gun owners or beauticians or anybody. It is insurance companies. And it's also the fact that this is the only way that you'll ever have a bipartisan approach because it involves both the market and involves a reasonable regulation. This is a regulation that everybody's comfortable with in terms of their vehicle.
Presumption is that if we had to insure your gun, that insurance companies would get in there and somehow tighten up because they wouldn't issue insurance or they'd charge so much if somebody didn't have a good gun locker or whatever.
Tom, I'm an attorney and I deal with insurance issues and I deal with domestic violence issues. If you got somebody that has a past that includes an arrest for domestic violence, and that is something that an insurance company is going to be looking for, they're going to make it so expensive for that person to own a gun over the long term that they just wouldn't do it. The same thing goes with straw purchasers. If straw purchasers have to show proof of insurance and then have to continue to pay the insurance, they're not going to keep the gun.
Well, I mean, you might be right, but I don't know if people aren't going to let the government come in and put any crimp in that gun pipeline. Why are they going to let insurance companies do it? But let us pick it up. David Hemingway, you think about public health. Here's our caller, Jim, in Atlanta. He's an attorney. He looks at insurance all the time. He says, get insurance companies involved here. Liability insurance, that'll get people to think very carefully about how many guns they want to pay insurance on and how safely they take care of them.
That's certainly an approach, and it would be nice to see a number of states try that to see what happens, if you could really do that and what the effect would be. It is important to recognize that, as opposed to illegal drugs, all guns in the United States begin as, quote, legal guns bought by someone who could pass a background check. And if they get into the hands of people who everyone agrees should not have them, a big question is, how did that happen? And one of the ways is through gun theft. We've just estimated on our most recent survey that there's between 300,000 to 500,000 guns stolen every year in the United States. We know that, yes, we have a lot of guns, but only about 20% of Americans are gun owners, or only about a third of households have guns. And if guns get into inner-city gangbangers, how do they get there? And one of the things we're trying to do is figure out ways to prevent the, quote, leakage from clearly the legal market, where hopefully there are always background checks, to the clearly illegal market. And you want to get distributors involved, because we know that there's better and worse ways to prevent straw purchasing among the gun dealers. There's a lot of people who can be involved.
So step by step. But are you not finding, we heard Wayne LaPierre there, that are you not opposed at every little step? I mean, you can't even do research on gun violence in this country because of that lobby.
Yes, absolutely. And what is interesting to me is that in virtually every success in public health, and there are scores and scores and scores, there are people's strong interests opposed. And public health is great because it's so pragmatic and keeps pushing and pushing and pushing, and suddenly things tip. We saw things tip about the tobacco in the United States. We saw things tip about fire-safe cigarettes. We've seen things tip in lots and lots of areas. Even sanitation in the 19th century, which I think everyone should be for, huge interests pushing and pushing against improved sanitation in the United States.
And we got it. Jean-Marc in Madison, Wisconsin. Jean-Marc, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. As a Canadian, I've been struggling with this question for so long. I've been in the United States for about 10 years. And with my ex-in-laws, I certainly learned to appreciate, like, sport gun culture, but also, like, they would buy each other guns for their anniversary one time. And I remember thinking, like, the most appropriate greeting card that could go with that is, like, happy anniversary, honey. You're statistically most likely to use this on me. And when I think about the car registration, the liability insurance, all those things are fantastic options as far as I'm concerned. But the one thing that I think I've determined kind of separates this issue in the United States as opposed to anywhere else in the world is, you know, those things create registration, which creates location. And there's this absurdly fantastical connection to the protection from tyranny element, which doesn't allow politicians and stuff to really talk about this rationally, because there's this overarching fear of, you know, going back, like you mentioned, to the Revolutionary
War. Well, I mean, you call it absurd, but Americans had a revolution about tyranny. Canadians didn't.
Sure. Fine. We took a little bit of a slower route. Absolutely. But, you know, there's other ways. You know, the system of checks and balances, the system of government that has developed over the centuries, that was, you know, laid by the founding fathers and all those sorts of things. There's other methods of protection. And when we talk about the Second Amendment, which we haven't talked about in detail really today so far, as I understand, you know, even when we just talk about, you know, coming into modern times and the idea that back then the idea of protecting yourself from a gun meant putting on a thicker coat.
Jean-Marc, I mean, you pointed at something that clearly is at the heart of a lot of this. Nick Kristof, you're a big sort of thematic thinker here, and that does seem to ride behind so many objections. You can parse it out in lots of ways with the sense that this is the last line of defense against tyranny. And for some Americans, I think even this death toll, 33,000 gun-related deaths a year, is the price of freedom.
Yeah, I mean, I think that while this notion of you know, protecting ourselves from dictators is there, I think that maybe the greater issue is that there are a lot of people who are nervous at home, and they feel that a gun at home is going to make them safer. And in fact, statistically, it's going to make them more likely to die at their own hand or the hand of somebody else in the house. But they don't perceive that. They think that, you know, if they know that those figures, they think they're the exception. So I think it's hard to change that culture, and it is changing slowly. The number of households that have guns in them has been going down. It's now about one third, and I think over time it may be possible to change the culture further. But I think that, you know, where there is room to achieve some real progress is things like safe storage. I think that it may be possible to move so that while people still give each other guns for their anniversary, that maybe they keep them in a gun safe, so that their kids are, you know, less likely to accidentally shoot themselves.
Well,
so
what about
that
smart
less
guns?
Likely to steal them.
You mentioned smart guns. You've written about them. This would require probably a fingerprint. The gun would recognize a fingerprint, and only someone with an authorized fingerprint could use the gun. What's the objection?
Right.
And you could be more than one. You could authorize your whole family. You could authorize your cousins. But
yeah, I mean, and this in the 19th century, we had a gun maker that was offering a smart gun that was a childproof gun. And yet, you know, now today, the gun lobby is just vociferously against smart guns that would, as you say, require a fingerprint, a pin. Another model has you have to wear a bracelet, and then you can fire the gun, but it's useless without that bracelet. And it is so absurd that, you know, if somebody steals my cell phone, they can't use it because it needs a pin, but they steal a gun and they can use it. Hopefully, there is going to be something of a market developing for these guns. If law enforcement pioneered this with smart gun purchases, that I think might give them more credibility, because I think a lot of gun buyers think that what law enforcement does, what police use, is, you know, that kind of gives it heft and
standard
gravitas.
Mm-hmm. Kat in Stanton, Virginia. Kat, thank you for calling. You're on.
Thank you. I don't think the general public realizes the extent to which there are so many people, not a fringe, who are preparing for some sort of apocalyptic scenario. They are stockpiling 22 rimfire cartridges. There's a severe shortage. You can't buy them. Now, the only reason you stockpile ammunition is not because you think there might be an intruder coming into your house. Mm. You don't need a stockpile for that. Mm-hmm. You need hundreds and hundreds of rounds, only if you think you're going to be shooting people when this total breakdown of society occurs. Now, of course, there are all these very specific scenarios, like JTELM 15. Everybody was shocked at what Texans thought, how many of them thought this.
These were the military exercises that became a cause celeb of opposition.
Right.
You know.
But that is, this sort of belief is unbelievably widespread among groups of people, and it makes the political situation extremely difficult, because you can't get anywhere if there are people who are protecting themselves, preparing for some sort of apocalyptic thing.
Kat, our time grows short, but let us pick that up if we may, and I appreciate your call. Adam Langford, is this a uniquely American dynamic? Do you give it the weight that Kat does at large?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. And actually, I think the apocalyptic fears and the fears of tyranny go together. One of the things that really struck me is we know that there's kind of our history is using guns to protect ourselves from tyranny. But with these public mass shooters, we really see that tyranny is in the eye of the beholder. And that's such a dangerous mindset. You know, the Roanoke shooter, he thought he was protecting himself from tyranny and oppression, and that, you know, he was engaged in essentially a revolutionary act of violence, you know, that was justified. So, you know, when people decide, you know, we're going to use violence and fight for our rights, frankly, which is an outdated mindset, right? These days in the modern world, you're supposed to talk through your problems. But when people say, I'm just going to rely on my gun to fight for justice, that is a major kind of social problem.
David Hemenway, in the history of public health movements, of course, there's always a psychological component. You have to get people to buy in. So how do you approach this challenge? Here we are.
Well, we clearly haven't been doing as good enough job as we should. People still think that having a gun in your home makes you safer when it doesn't. I think the big thing is always to get people first to understand that there really is a problem, to accept that there is a problem, and secondly, that they can do something about it, that you don't always just focus on the individual, focus on who's the one bad guy, who's the one crazy person, and that that's somehow going to solve the problem. And what you're trying to figure out is how to create a system where it's hard to make mistakes and hard to behave inappropriately.
Who's going to raise that message? I mean, even Alison Parker's father, one of the two shot on camera last week, Andy Parker, we heard him at the top of the show saying, we don't have a gun, probably going to have to get one. It's just the world we live in. Who's going to turn his mind around?
Hopefully more and more people getting involved. That's what's changed in almost all the success stories. It's just took a long time. It's pushing and pushing and pushing against these forces that don't want which public health thinks are beneficial change. And eventually, somehow, things start to tip, and they can tip very rapidly when they do tip.
Nick Kristof, are you whistling in the wind when you call for that kind of tip in the other direction here, or do you sense something moving despite all the guns and all the gun violence in our culture that might begin to look at this in a new way?
You know, I have so many friends who are completely pessimistic and think this is a hopeless issue. I'm not in that category. You know, I look at other countries that have similar backgrounds in America, as America, similar traditions of having guns in the household. You know, you look at Switzerland, where every male essentially had an assault weapon. You look at Australia, at Canada. These are countries that had similar traditions and yet managed to move forward. And I think at some point we are going to slowly, cautiously, actually make some progress on this issue.
Chris Christie says maybe background checks, but no new laws. We've got plenty of laws. You agree, Nick?
Oh, I mean, what really frustrates me is that these Republican presidential candidates are talking about the importance of mental health. And absolutely, we do a terrible job on mental health in this country. We need to do a better job. But we also need to do a better job with the tools that mentally ill people sometimes use. We need to address mental health. We need to address guns.
Well, a public health perspective may be the beginning of a new way of looking at this. Certainly, there's evidence enough we need to do something. Nick Kristof with the New York Times, thank you very much for being with us today, Nick.
My pleasure.
Adam Langford, University of Alabama. Thank you, Professor Langford.
Thank you.
And David Hemenway, author of Private Guns, Public Health from Harvard School of Public Health. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
This is On Point.